Tentor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Companion to Marx's Grundrisse by David Harvey. Narrated by David Stifel. Publisher's note: the print and ebook versions of this book include visual elements. You will hear the visuals discussed and referenced in this audiobook. Author's Introduction. This companion to Marx's Grundrisse is another contribution to what I call in retrospect the Marx Project. I say in retrospect because it is only when I look back that I can see that I have been engaged on this project over many years. It did not begin with a conscious purpose or design. It just grew. The impulse behind the project, which began some 2 decades ago, has, however, remained both clear and constant. I felt a pressing need to communicate, as clearly and simply as possible, what it was that Marx had uncovered in his critique of classical political economy. I also wanted to explore how the insights gained thereby could usefully illuminate the sources of the economic, social, ecological, and political troubles and dangers that were becoming more and more salient across the globe. Marx's writings, I felt, were incisively relevant to understanding why capital not only was failing to meet human needs, but was also totally unable to stave off the dangers of environmental degradation. His works helped explain why capital was bound in the long run to fail on both counts. Most people, when confronted with Marx's voluminous works on the critique of political economy, find them difficult, intimidating, and confusing. As a result, there have arisen a variety of interpretations of his work by scholars and activists alike, coalescing, in some instances, into what appear to be factions, or even whole schools of thought, as to what the correct line is for elaborating on Marx's theoretical contributions. Political parties of the left, particularly of a communist persuasion, have often shaped distinctive but somewhat rigid interpretations suited to their political situation and agendas. Marx, being the controversial figure that he is, has also attracted his share of personal vilification from opponents. Deliberate misrepresentations and false representations abound, along with more sophisticated and subtle attempts to undermine his views. All of this creates expectations and a climate of presumption and prejudgment that makes a simple and uncluttered reading of any of his texts virtually impossible. My aim was and is to open a door into Marx's thinking and to encourage as many people as possible to pass through it and take a closer look at the texts and make of them what they will. I have no interest in trying to impose my own particular interpretations on anyone. That is why I call my books on Marx companions rather than guides. I cannot, of course, open a path to an understanding of Marx's thought without using my own experience and interests as crucial helpmates for interpretation. The fact that my main interest has been urbanization and uneven geographical development at a variety of scales clearly affects the way I evaluate Marx's texts. I imagine myself, however, accompanying the reader on a long hike in which I point out this and that particular feature here and there, drawing upon my long experience of working with the text, and highlight moments of epiphany for me, linking ideas together when possible, while always wondering and asking what it is that you, the reader, might make of it all. In teaching Marx over the last 50 years, I have been incredibly fortunate to teach it to all sorts of different groups and audiences. I have learned immensely from the very divergent ways in which people can make sense of what Marx is saying. This is, of course, a tribute to the rich complexity of the texts, that they can speak so directly to so many different people living in such radically different situations and coming from such radically different cultural and intellectual traditions. The Grundrisse is by far the most interesting and the most difficult book by Marx to work with. It is a set of notes that Marx was frantically writing to himself at a rather frantic time. Marx, throughout his lifetime, employed different modes of writing depending upon his audience. These can be categorized into four types. There was first the writing style adopted in his journalism, in his contemporary commentaries, and in his correspondence. It is plain-spoken and colloquial, even as it takes on difficult matters with some conceptual grace. Some of his serious writings on political economy were prepared for publication, such as Volume 1 of Kapital. There, he is greatly concerned to use a language which he thinks his audience will understand. That audience was the literate fraction of a working class, the majority of whom were illiterate. The literate fraction was self-taught, quite sophisticated, and being autodidacts, unlikely to be subject to the disciplinary tropes of formal education. So while Kapital may appear to us as a difficult book, somewhat above the capacity of the average undergraduate in formal education to easily comprehend, this would not necessarily be true for the autodidact artisans that Marx was concerned to influence, primarily in Britain and France, but also in the United States and beyond. My own hope in my Marx project has been to recast Marx's language in a way more accessible to contemporary student audiences, along with the autodidacts. Yes, they still exist, in the labor unions and social movements. The third kind of writing is more experimental. It is constructed as a voyage of discovery, where Marx will unfold an argument, sometimes deploying novel and even arcane concepts for anyone willing to follow. This is characteristic of the manuscripts out of which Engels constructed both volumes 2 and 3 of Kapital. The fourth kind of writing is Marx writing purely for himself, using whatever tools and ideas that he has in his head, prepared to unleash a stream of his own consciousness, to set down possibilities and potential interrelations that may or may not turn out to be important in his more considered studies. This last is the predominant style of the Grundrisse, and it is this that makes it such an exciting, frustrating, imaginative, and sometimes boringly repetitive text to work with. Marx is, in short, just talking to himself. It is not sufficient to understand his language, which is distinctly his own. It is also important to understand his mode of thinking, which is, to put it mildly, somewhat elusive. But this is the form of writing that dominates in the Grundrisse. One of the things that makes reading and interpreting the Grundrisse so difficult is determining whether Marx is advancing his own conceptual framework and interpretations, or simply reporting upon that of others. For example, at the very outset of the introduction, he states, "Individuals producing in society, hence socially determined individual production, is of course the point of departure." We can read this as saying that this is where he, Marx, proposes to start, or as Marx saying that since this is where bourgeois political economy typically starts, then this is where he is obliged to start his own critical interrogation. The outcome is often a fusion of both. He may end up saying that socially determined individual production is a good and appropriate place to start, provided we interpret the individual in a different way from that given in bourgeois political economy. I note in passing, however, that Marx begins Kapital with the commodity, which was definitely his own choice. Marx does not think the bourgeois political economists were idiots, liars, or mere apologists. Some of them may have been that, but certainly not Adam Smith and Ricardo, and the host of other thinkers, like James Stewart, William Petty, Sismondi, Canet, and even on occasion Thomas Malthus, who preceded or succeeded them. Marx regarded most of the bourgeois political economists as honest journeymen and scientists, seeking desperately to understand the confusing and enormously complex political and economic changes occurring around them. They provided Marx with the raw materials for his own interpretations, and if only for that reason, commanded respect. But there is plenty of unfinished business in the Grundrisse, as well as in Marx's work in general, as to what is distinctive to Marx and what is derivative from the bourgeois political economy of the time. This is very much the case, for example, with respect to Marx's concept of value, which to this day has never been firmly defined to everyone's satisfaction. Marx, in the Grundrisse, is not always consistent with himself. He sometimes changes conceptual apparatuses in midstream. The meaning of key concepts evolves as the text unfolds. He is often unsure as to exactly where he is going. The result is a somewhat messy, complex, but open and episodically incisive analysis. But then, capital is a somewhat messy, complex economic system, and the Grundrisse, often by happenstance, mirrors this complexity in some pretty astonishing ways. There are, however, different ways to read this text. A very close, deep, and systematic reading would take a long time. It is easy to spend a week wrestling with the meaning of just a few pages. Other readings take a particular angle on Marx's thinking. For instance, philosophers might read it looking for how Marx is appropriating Hegel or Spinoza, while economists are typically drawn to how Marx is appropriating Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and the socialist Ricardians. Marx frequently argues in opposition to Proudhon and the French socialists. I do not find that commentary particularly enlightening or interesting. For this reason, I tend to give the debate with Proudhon short shrift in this reading. I am furthermore not equipped, by intellect or temperament, to wrestle with the complexity of the Hegelian influence and the extensive philosophical explorations of Marx's language and method. I appreciate the work done by others on these topics, but those interested in it must needs look elsewhere. Marx was not only seeking in this text to come to terms with Ricardo and Hegel, he was also engaged, in my view, in a titanic struggle to emancipate himself from the limiting categories of Ricardian analysis and the prison house of Hegelian formulations. I here concentrate, therefore, on what Marx defines as his central mission in the Grundrisse. This he states as follows. The exact development of the concept of capital is necessary, since it is the fundamental concept of modern economics, just as capital is the foundation of bourgeois society. The sharp formulation of the basic presuppositions of the capital relation must bring out all the contradictions of bourgeois production, as well as the boundary where it drives beyond itself. 331. See note on page 21. I anchor this reading of the Grundrisse around this problematic. Marx was concerned not only to understand the concept of capital and its elaboration in the world of thought. He was also concerned to come to terms with capital as it was operating on the ground, and how its abstract laws of motion, albeit riven with contradictions, were not only producing economic crises, such as that of 1857-58, but were also dictating conditions of life and labor for the mass of the population in the then capitalist world. Capital is, of course, still with us, and the unfolding of its inner laws of motion, along with all its inner contradictions, is omnipresent, though perhaps dressed in new clothing, and perhaps practiced at a much expanded scale. A dose of Marx's revelatory discoveries can therefore shed a great deal of light on our contemporary capitalist world, even as we recognize that this world is very much in flux, and in some respects very different from the one which Marx inhabited. Yet there are also reasons to think that the chief elements of Marx's theoretical conception are more relevant now than they have ever been. When Marx was writing, industrial, as opposed to merchant capital, was dominant in only a small corner of the world, Britain, Western Europe, and the eastern seaboard of the United States. But the kind of factory conditions which Marx depicts in Kapital in the chapter on the working day can now be found in Bangladesh, China, Turkey, Brazil, India, Guatemala, and South Africa, just to name a few places. Capital has, moreover, scaled up to the edge of the globe, and while this scaling up calls for theoretical adjustments, it deepens rather than lessens the contradictions to which capital as an economic system is prone. On the other hand, the complexity of class formations and class relations on the world stage makes the applications of some of Marx's theorizations, as we shall see, problematic. There is, however, a structure to Marx's seemingly chaotic inquiry in the Grundrisse. It is important to be aware of this structure when studying the text. Marx aims to investigate the formation and functioning of capital as a totality. This aspect of Marx's approach has largely been ignored in contemporary commentaries. I suspect the turn to Foucault and post-structuralism, which holds totalizing discourses and, ergo, any evocation of the concept of the totality in anathema, is partly to blame. It may also be because earlier attempts to deploy the concept of totality, by, for example, Lukács, were found to be misleading and inadequate. But Hegel's concept of totality is of a closed, self-contained, and self-sustaining entity, and it was this concept of totality that proved, correctly in my view, to be so inadequate. Marx seeks to emancipate himself from this Hegelian conception. Marx's totality is open, evolving, self-replicating, to be sure, but in no sense self-sustaining, given its internal contradictions and its metabolic relation to both nature and to the cumulative historical achievements of human cultures. Marx depicts capital as an organic totality and treats it as a complex ecosystem in continuous historical formation. But Marx limits his inquiries, for the most part, to the totality of capital and not of everything. While capital may be the driving force, the foundational process within bourgeois society, it does not say everything that needs to be said about capitalism as a social formation. The theory of capital as a mode of production is one thing. The theory of capitalism as a social formation is quite another. In the Grundrisse, Marx mainly focuses on the former, even as some of his asides clearly target the latter. The ecosystemic analogy is important here. In the same way that researchers may conceptualize and isolate for study whole ecosystems such as the tropical rainforest, the tundra, wetlands, or even urban ecosystems as totalities, each totality comprised of multiple species in relation or competition with each other, knitted together by energy flows including those emanating from outside, so Marx seeks to isolate for study capital's ecosystem, with its complex intersecting divisions of labor, competition, specializations of function, forms of distribution, and money flows. This totality of capital is, in some respects, like a human body, though this analogy will prove misleading if pushed too far. Marx at one point pursues exactly this analogy to elucidate the importance of differential turnover times. In the human body, as with capital, the different elements are not exchanged at the same rate of reproduction. Blood renews itself more rapidly than muscle, muscle than bone, which in this respect may be regarded as the fixed capital of the human body. 670. The human body circulates blood through the heart and oxygen through the lungs, ingests energy through the digestive system and the stomach, deals with waste through the liver and kidneys, while coordination is exercised through the brain and the central nervous system. Each of these circulation processes is autonomous and independent, and subject to specialized knowledge in the form of cardiology, neurology, urology, etc., but subsumed within the logic of the totality of a human body as a functioning system. It makes no sense to assign a hierarchical structure of importance or causality to the interactions and interrelations between all these different circulation processes. The failure of any one of them threatens the life and existence of the totality. In the Grundrisse, Marx decomposes capital into different circulation processes. He begins with the study of monetary circulation. Not all money is capital. Capital is money circulating in a particular way. But monetary circulation has to be studied as autonomous and independent, performing all manner of social functions other than that required in the flow of money as capital. Money becomes money capital through its encounter with and purchase of the capacity to labor. This sparks an analysis of the circulation process of the capacity to labor, Figure 1. Capital, value, flows through the different moments of 1, page 15, commodity purchase, labor power and means of production, 2, a labor process producing surplus value, 3, realization through sale in the market, 4, distribution, and 5, reinvestment. This forms a distinctive circulation process of capital in general. Figure 2, page 18. The flow of capital can be divided into two distinctive paths: those of circulating capital, with a turnover on an annual basis, and those of long-term fixed capital, for example, machinery, together with flows into the consumption fund, for example, housing. Figure 3, page 296. Fixed capital and long-term consumption fund formation take on a special character and significance. They both intersect with the circulation of interest-bearing capital, which supports and coordinates them. This connection is only occasionally mentioned in the Grundrisse, even though it is usually incorporated in the various plans that Marx lays out to guide his future work. The circulation of interest-bearing capital is taken up in detail, of course, in Volume 3 of Kapital. There are other circulation processes that could be incorporated, but Marx leaves them to one side in the Grundrisse, except in the various plans. The circulation of state revenues through taxation and public investments is notably lacking, except for a brief commentary on road building. The totality of capital is not pre-given or predefined. It is not some ideal type waiting to be revealed or discovered, nor is it fixed and determinate with respect to its reach in space and time. While the idea of totality undoubtedly derives from Hegel, Marx reworks it and revolutionizes it, as he does with almost everything else taken from Hegel. For Marx, the totality is a network of historically specific social practices and relations built and evolving over time through human action. This network is constantly in the process of growth and transformation, perpetually becoming, as he puts it, even as it exhibits certain tendencies toward permanence. The emphasis, however, is upon the fluidity of the processes that sustain and create it. But the crystallization of various features within the totality can guide, inhibit, imprison, or exacerbate the processes that historically constitute it. This crystallization can, from time to time, become downright sclerotic. It then appears as if humanity has imprisoned itself in its own web of social, class relations, institutional arrangements, for example, the law, and social interactions. It constantly finds itself straining to break the bonds and barriers that it has itself created. This is the foundational contradiction within the capitalist mode of production. The Grundrisse is structured as an inquiry into the different circulation processes that produce and support capital as a totality. We have 1. The circulation of commodities through exchange. 2. The circulation of money as money. 3. The circulation of the capacity to labor, figure 1. 4. The circulation of money as capital, figure 2. 5. The circulation of fixed capital, figure 3. 6. The circulation of interest-bearing capital, not studied but mentioned in the Grundrisse. Other circulation processes might be incorporated into this framework, such as the circulation of financial, banking capital, and the circulation of state revenues. Volume 2 of Kapital, it is worth noting, is dominated by the study of different circulatory systems, beginning with the circulation of money, commodities, and productive capital, and the circulation of all three forms within capital as a whole. Later in that volume, Marx examines the circulation of fixed capital and studies working periods and turnover times, with subsequent chapters on the circulation of variable capital and surplus value, culminating in the modeling of circulation relations between capital and labor in the so-called reproduction schemas. The Grundrisse is an illuminating precursor to much of that. The boundedness of the totality, both structurally and geographically, is to some degree arbitrarily imposed by the investigator, even when there are strong concrete conditions that logically support a particular definition of boundedness. In the case of the human body, to follow on with this analogy, there are strong reasons to treat of it as a functioning totality in itself for purposes of medical investigation, diagnosis, and analysis, but the general social conditions in which that body operates cannot be ignored in any approach to health conditions in society. While, for example, a cause of death might be very specific from the medical standpoint, the context of substance abuse and opioid addictions, of alienation and social enemy, and of all the economic and social reasons that lie behind these phenomena are of great significance to understanding recent trends in morbidity. While Marx isolates capital, what he calls the inner structure of the social system, to concentrate attention on the production, consumption, realization, and distribution of value, he clearly recognizes that there is a far broader totality within which this arbitrarily abstracted totality called capital has its being. Hence, in Figure 2, we see the metabolic relation to nature and the construction of a second nature through urbanization, along with the production of space and place relations, as contextually significant to the more narrowly defined and bounded model of capital circulation. The same can be said of capital's relation to human knowledge, social relations, culture and tradition in existing populations, to conditions of social reproduction, and to the constant shaping and reshaping of the wants, needs, and desires that get expressed through the diverse expressions of human consumerism. What Marx subjects to analysis is the totality of capital within the much broader totality of capitalism. His reason for so doing is that he sees capital as the economic engine, the foundational powerhouse, the source of the abstract forces to which all of us are willy-nilly obligated and bound to some degree. One word of warning on Marx's method of inquiry. He situates himself with respect to his subject matter in a very specific way. He typically interprets what he is looking at in a pure form, free of contamination from so-called external influences, such as those just described, or particular complications. In the chapter dealing with money, for example, he proceeds as if the circulation of money capital has no role. Throughout the text, he frequently indicates issues that he will take up later, or matters that we are not at this point in the analysis equipped to handle. This renders much of what he says contingent on context rather than definitive. Marx recognizes that many of his fixed suppositions themselves.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?